normally when we open up a show with the word stunning, which I think we've done more than once, it's a positive reaction to something we've just played. And I think this morning the use of it is a pretty fitting term for hearing the news of Bowie's passing.
Yeah, just a few hours ago.
Yeah, and coming right off the heels of him turning 69.
Yeah, and releasing his latest album on his 69th birthday.
Yes, and it's interesting because I was thinking about him lately because they are doing that show Lazarus, mm-hmm. fittingly enough titled, using his music on Broadway right now. And I'd seen on Colbert's show, they had the guy who played Dexter singing a great rendition of a Bowie tune. And I was thinking, God, you know, it's great that Bowie is still doing stuff. Even if he's not touring, I'm glad that he's still doing something fresh.
Right. I mean, I don't know about you, but I didn't know anything about him suffering from cancer for the last 18 months.
No, apparently only the people closest to him. And, you know, he was always intensely private about everything.
Yeah.
So it's not surprising to me, but it is interesting. It's sort of like a George situation where he's sort of racing against the clock to get this final album out while he was sick.
Yeah.
And unlike George, he actually made it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is a striking comparison.
Yes.
And normally, you know, somebody like Bowie, who is such a giant in rock as an artist in their own right, you know, it's not like they need to rely on anybody else's coattails. And yet, when we look at the ties to the Beatles, they're considerable.
Yes, they are. I mean, he was born in, 1947, so he was a few years younger than all of the Beatles.
Yeah, but he was still active in the 60s as a recording artist.
Davy Jones.
Yeah, Davy Jones in the lower third.
Yes.
In the 60s as, you know, one of these people that sort of entered rock like a lot of Brits did, covering R&B and sort of emulating American soul before he eventually found his own voice.
Yes.
And of course, he had to change his name so as not to be confused with the monkey from Manchester.
Yes.
Unless anybody make that confusion.
The monkey from Manchester. Did you... have you ever seen that clip that's on, it's on YouTube of Davy Jones, the Bowie Davy Jones, in 1964 on Britain's Tonight Show? It's BBC, and it's with an interviewer called Cliff Mitchell-Moore. Mm. And it's Davy Jones with some of his classmates at school and protesting about people, you know, that he's basically campaigning for long hair.
Oh, you know, this sounds very familiar. I'm sure I saw it at some point.
And he's blonde, and I think he's 15 years old, something like, oh, no, must mean 17 years old, actually, in 64.
Yeah.
And he's got blonde hair, and he's saying that people say things like, hello, darling, and where's your handbag, and it's got to stop. Fantastic bit of footage.
Yeah, kind of like a Jimmy Page thing.
So anyway, what we opened the show with, of course, was Bowie with John Lennon on a song that they basically contrived, you know, in the studio called Fame.
Yeah, it wasn't a co-write in the usual sense where they sat down to write a song together. It just sort of evolved in the studio.
Yes.
And, you know, I guess part of the lyrical content was Bowie drawing upon conversations he'd had with John about the nature of fame.
Yes.
Which you know, you get, when you look at the lyrics, you can it's pretty evident.
And that came in that whole period when John was also collaborating with Elton John. So two top UK artists of the 70s, Bowie and Elton John, that John Lennon aligned himself with.
Well, he was off the leash during that time.
Yeah.
The most fruitful period of his post-Beatle career, unquestionably, as much as you would try to characterize it later as, you know, the lost weekend, and he was at the bottom of a bottle, desperately, you know, living this life, trying to get back to Yoko, which is nonsense when you look at what he produced during that period.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I would say this as an observation, and not, I don't want you to perceive this as an insult, but I would think that of the four Beatles, I think John was the most comfortable with androgyny.
Yeah, most likely true.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
And therefore, it's probably not an accident that he felt most comfortable with these two androgynous artists of the day.
Have you seen him, John, I forgot which year it is, if it's 73 or 74 or 75, the Grammy Awards, where he's up on the
75.
Stage with Paul Simon.
Yes.
And he's camping it up.
Yes, yeah, he's got the beret and the Elvis pin. Yeah.
Yeah,
that was just after the separation ended. And it's, of course, you know, they had one big public event before, you know, the walls went back up and he was not associating with rock stars.
And of course, you've seen that footage from 73 With Tony King dressed up as the Queen and Elton John.
Yeah. The Mind Games promotional stuff.
Yeah, and John's dancing with Tony King and camping it up again.
Well, you want to go back even further. You've got Around the Beatles and the Shakespeare Midsummer Night's Dream.
Fisbee.
Yeah, who's the one in drag?
Yes. Right. Yeah. So anyway, what we should play here actually is a clip from John Lennon's interview with Bob Harris on BBC TV's Old Grey Whistle Test in 1975. Yes.
Yeah.
And he talks about collaborating with David Bowie.
How did the involvement with David Bowie come about?
Well, he sort of seems to be in New York, right? And I seem to be the guy in New York that all the Englishmen say hi to, you know. And which is good, you know, if Mick's in town, Paul's in town, anybody comes, I love it, you know. All the rockers come and say, hey, what's happening, you know? And I'm supposed to show them what's happening. Or they already know, most of them anyway. And I got to know David through Mick, really, although I'd met him once before. And next minute he says, hello, John, I'm doing the Cross the Universe. Do you want to come on down? So I says, all right, you know, I live here. I popped down and I played rhythm. You know. And then he had this lick, you know, we'd finished Across the Universe and this guitarist had a lick, so we sort of wrote this song, you know, it was no big deal. We just sort of, boom, 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 you know, like that. It wasn't like sitting down to write a song, so we made this lick into a song is what happened. And that's how it happened, and there it is, you know. Mm. And people are all saying, well, what's he doing with Elton John and David Bowie? I'm doing it because it's fun, you know. Elton and I are very close, you know. David, I know him quite well, but I don't know him as well as Elton. It was just, you know, what do you say? I'm doing your song. You want to come on? I'll come.
So it's probably worth mentioning how the two came into each other's orbit in end of 74, early 75, was that Bowie had wanted to do a cover of Across the Universe. And I think he wanted John's blessing. So he kind of reached out. He didn't know him personally at that point. And it's funny, if you think back a few months before that, when John's doing that interview with Dennis Elsis on WNEW, and he's reading the commercials. And he talks about some club that was having a ladies' night. He goes, oh, good, Bowie can get in, if you remember that.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think that's before they'd actually ever physically met. Yeah. But so he reached out, and the word got out to John that, you know, David Bowie would like to do a cover of Across the Universe, and he'd really like it if you wanted to play guitar on it. Mm-hmm. And that was how that got set into motion. And once they were in the studio together and they did the version of Across the Universe, that's what set the table for Fame then coming into being.
Right, yeah.
Which ended up being, you know, Bowie had sort of a middling success in America to that point, sort of an FM kind of slash cult artist.
Yes.
But, you know, just as Elton and John together had the number one with Whatever Gets You Through the Night, and also the remake of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, you know, it's whoever John collaborated with at that time was like, you know, the golden touch.
Yeah.
Because Bowie got his first number one single out of it.
Absolutely.
The first of two that he would have in his entire career.
Yeah.
The second being Let's Dance.
Yeah. So, yeah, a fantastic period, actually, at the time. You know, I didn't appreciate it as much as I do now, looking back, you know, with 2020 hindsight. But at the time, it was like, I think a bit irked that, you know, Elton John was now the hot name when they did, like, Lucy in the Sky as a single. And, you know, again, with Bowie, it was the Bowie name. And, oh, he's done it with John Lennon.
Yeah.
And, of course, for me, John was the star, you know. So, but now looking back, great period again and great collaborations.
And that would have been a superb road, a really exciting path for him to have continued on.
Oh, God, yeah.
Had events not played out. I'm not just saying, you know, doing a succession of collaborations with David Bowie, per se, but the fact that I think that John and Paul were both, in the solo years, particularly reticent about collaborating with peers.
Yes.
You know, they were few and far between. They tended to be one-offs. And I think in John's case, it was because when he was with Yoko, that door was just shut.
Yeah.
She was not going to compete with anybody else or allow him to.
Yeah, of course.
And, you know, Paul had Wings, and it wasn't until post-Wings, really, that they started collaborating with, you know, Stevie Wonder and Carl Perkins and all those folk with Tug of War.
Yeah.
But I think had the separation period not come to an end the way it did, the road that John was on, where he had redeemed himself commercially with a number one album and a number one single, I think he finally was feeling some sort of parity with Paul, who was very, very conscious of his position commercially alongside. And there was the talk of their collaborating in New Orleans that didn't come to fruition. But I think if it had, and John maintain this openness to working with people on his peer level, what amazing things we would have seen.
Yeah. Getting back to Bowie, so, you know, there's no doubt that, like many people of his generation, the Beatles had a major musical cultural impact on the guy.
Sure.
And, you know, as you were saying earlier, that, you know, he kind of was experimenting musically, Bowie, through the 60s before he really kind of found his own niche.
Which was all-encompassing as it played out.
Yeah, certainly was. But, you know, as early as 65... listen to this track that he did. It's called That's Where My Heart Is.
Mm.
And it sounds as if, you know, he's writing songs that are influenced by what he's heard up to that point.
Yes.
With the first few Beatles albums.
I just cannot believe that you want me, that you don't. I just cannot believe that you want me forevermore. Time and time I tried to make you mine. I didn't think it would be such a short time before you came my way. Up where the moon is shining so bright, that's where my heart is tonight. Up where the moon is so bright, that's where my heart is tonight.
So what do you think? Do you hear, you know, strains of Beatles? I imagine that he's been listening to With the Beatles, you know.
You know what? It struck me, my impression of it initially. I mean, certainly production-wise, it doesn't sound like Beatles. But
right.
Songwriting-wise, I can hear sort of like their Decca efforts
right.
in there.
Yeah,
like you're really working really hard to try to write a meaningful song.
Yes.
It's less natural and intuitive.
Correct.
Yeah, which is not a criticism. I mean, what's cool about it, though, is at that early age, and he's still a teenager.
Yeah, he's still 17 or 18. Then.
Yeah, it is so Bowie.
Yeah.
You know, a mile away. And you said that was 1965?
Yes, it was.
I'm guessing that wasn't a hit single.
That's Where My Heart Is.
That was not a hit of any kind.
No,
right?
No. And it would have been as Davy Jones he was recording at that time.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, from that same year, now that you've prompted the thought in my head, the Mersey's, you familiar with that band?
Yes.
They had the hit Sorrow that
right.
year. And what
with
Sorrow
your
was...
eyes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was going to say, if any American fans are familiar with the song at all, and it was a hit in England, but it's not one that ever got played in the radio here that I'm aware
okay.
of. If you're familiar with it at all,
yeah.
it's because George quoted it. And it's all too much.
That's right. He throws in a... Actually, let's listen to that little bit.
With your long blonde hair and your eyes of blue. With your long blonde hair and your eyes of blue. The only thing I ever get from you.
And I know when I was hearing that song, which I always loved, It's All Too Much.
Yes.
I just thought, oh, he's evoking Patty.
Right.
And maybe he is, but he's using somebody else's song that would have been familiar to listeners, at least in Britain.
Yeah.
But anyway, the reason I bring it up at all is that when Bowie did the Pinups album in 73, which is an album of all covers, you know, I guess, you know, stuff that meant a lot to him in his early years, like he does The Who's Can't Explain and other stuff. Anyway, he does that.
Yes.
And that was issued as a single in 73, went to number 3.
Right.
It was a big hit.
Right.
This
well, what about in another big Bowie hit, Young Americans, where he kind of...
Oh, no, we're all over the place.
Yeah, no, but you know, in there, he
evokes the Beatles directly.
He evokes the Beatles directly, doesn't he?
Did you notice he changes the line, though?
Yes.
Said, I think a lot of people, hearing the song, you'll immediately get the a Day in a Life connection of, I read the news today, oh boy.
Yeah.
Except he sings, I heard the news today, oh boy.
It's kind of cool when they do that, artist. I love it. It's not just, you know, a word here. It's a definite line that you pick up instantly.
In a song that sounds nothing like A Day in the Life.
Right. Yeah, he just throws it in.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I love that stuff. The familiar little tip of the hat.
Yes.
On that album, that was the Station to Station album, 1976.
Yes, yeah.
This was the thing that always caught my ears, and going back from day one, when that was a new song, the song Golden Years.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a big radio hit at the time. And I guess being informed by the fact that Fame was the big hit the year before, mm-hmm. and I'm hearing Golden Years, and the song starts out, you know, don't let me hear you say life's taking you nowhere, Angel.
Right.
Caught my ears. It's like, and I remember thinking to myself, oh, another Lennon collaboration. Because it unmistakably is John Lennon.
Yeah, you had me listen to this. I have to be honest, you introduced this to me, mm-hmm. and I'm listening, and it sounds Bowie-ish, but when you listen closely, mm-hmm. it does sound that it is John Lennon on that first go-around.
So let's do an A-B comparison. The first time, because the first time he sings it, it's clearly John, and the rest of the song, when it comes up, it's Bowie.
Don't let me hear you say life's taking you nowhere. Let me hear you say life's taking you nowhere.
It does require a very close listen, I have to say.
It does, but for whatever reason, when I was a kid, it just jumped out of the speakers, and I was like, oh, wow. And so then, you know, you come of age, you do a bit of research, you pick up the album, no John Lennon credit on there whatsoever.
Right.
So it's like, oh, okay, so it's an uncredited appearance. But then I didn't find this to be a universal consensus. I didn't read about it in any Beatle books mm-hmm. until I wrote my own Fab Four FAQ 2.0, where I did do the research and pointed out, you know, that at the time that album was recorded, it was when Lennon was easing into his semi-retirement. He was not actively recording
right,
at that
time.
Right,
that's right. He wouldn't have been around and going into the studio. At
right,
that
and it's doubtful he would have walked in to contribute one word and then leave.
Because the last time that he contributed and went into a commercial studio, wasn't that for Ringo?
Yeah, it was in 76 for Cooking.
Cooking, yeah.
Yeah, for Rhoda Grevier, yeah, which was June of 76, I believe.
Right.
And this, so at the time, I found out when this album was recorded, and Lennon was not known to be recording at that time.
Yeah.
And one day when I ran into Earl Slick, the guitarist, who worked with Bowie and also worked with Lennon, I asked him about it. And he, in a very colorful way, expressed that he had no recollection of it.
Right.
But what I concluded is it was probably a piece of tape from when they worked together before that
yes.
Bowie flew in
yes.
and just used.
Right.
But, you know, you judge for yourself with your own ears, listeners.
So, you know, also I want to say that, you know, this morning Paul McCartney did issue a statement. And it went like this. Very sad news to wake up on this raining morning. David was a great star and I treasure the moments we had together. His music played a very strong part in British musical history. And I'm proud to think of the huge influence he has had on people all around the world. I send my deepest sympathies to his family and will always remember the great laughs we had through the years. His star will shine in the sky forever. Hmm. And that brings me to, you know,
Live Aid.
Well, there's that they did share a stage, I think, at the very end when it was like the grand finale of Live Aid.
Wembley.
Yeah, Wembley Stadium.
Yeah, I remember the image of, I think it was Townsend and McCartney that had Bob Geldof. They were
Correct.
Carrying him.
Yes. Yeah.
I don't remember specifically Bowie being part of that, although surely he would have been on stage for the finale.
Right. But what I was coming to was, if you listen to the intro of Oh You Pretty Things,
mm-hmm.
To me, that is definitely McCartney-inspired piano playing on there. It really sounds like something off Abbey Road.
Mm. Let's hear it.
Yeah, let's take a listen.
Wake up, you sleepy head. Put on some clothes, shake up your bed. Put another log on the fire for me. I made some breakfast and coffee. Look out my window, what do I see? A crack in the sky and a hand reaching down to me. All the nightmares came today, and it looks as though they're here to stay. What are we coming to? No room for me, no fun for you. I'll think about a world to come where the books were found by the golden ones. Written in pain, written in all by a puzzle man who questioned what we were here for. All the strangers came today, and it looks as though they're here.
So, very kind of Abbey Road, Golden Slumbers, Martha, My Dear, off the White Album, that kind of vibe,
kind of
isn't
piano-based,
it?
Yeah. Did you know who recorded it before Bowie did?
No.
And he did write, you know, Bowie wrote it, but yeah. Peter Noone recorded it first.
Oh, that, I've heard that. I have heard that.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Yeah, I failed the quiz there, but yeah, I do remember that.
I hope you like his new direction.
That's another show.
Yes. So that was 1971 off of Hunky Dory.
Right.
So you have this guy who, he was defined by his constantly shedding one persona, one after another.
Yeah.
You know, Ziggy Stardust being probably the best known one in America.
Yes.
Aladdin Sane being in there, I think, subsequent.
Right.
Thin White Duke.
Yeah.
You know, which was the, I think when he was doing the Berlin trilogy with, God, who was producing him?
Tony Visconti.
Well, Tony Visconti, but then he was working with, was it John Cale?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, look it up, folks. We're vamping here. But you get the point that I think everything that everybody knows, if you know one thing about Bowie, was he was many, many personas.
Yes.
And he produced some great stuff under each guise, you know, different sounds all along the way.
Well, in fact, you talk about the Berlin Trilogy. One of those is the Heroes album.
Yes.
And on there, take a listen to this track Blackout again and see if you think there's Beatles influence in there. I personally think there is. Now, don't you think that's a little bit, again, White Album-ish? You know, it's not as wild as Helter Skelter, but it's got that kind of feel to it.
In as much as it's chaotic, I could see that, sure.
Yeah.
For Bowie especially. I said John Cale a minute ago. Who I meant was Brian Eno.
Brian Eno, yeah.
Yeah, that's who he was collaborating with. Yeah. And it's funny, you mentioned Tony Visconti, and there is a man with Beatle-Apple connections of his own, of course.
Beatle, yeah, all the way down the line as well. You know, he married Mary Hopkin.
Right, who sings on the Bowie album Low, which was the first of the trilogy.
Yeah. And then our friend May Pang was his second wife.
Yeah. Right.
Yes. and he's done orchestrations for Paul McCartney.
Right, and he produced the Ivies.
Yep.
Who became Badfinger, of course.
Yeah.
So, very much part of the Apple circle early on.
Yes.
And then he went on to work with Bowie.
Now,
speaking of Apple.
Go on.
I was going to say, among the Apple stable of artists that didn't really click was in, they were trying to stage manage her comeback, was Ronnie Spector.
Ronnie Spector, yeah.
Which is, you know, opens the door wide to, you know, George having crafted some material expressly for Ronnie.
Mm-hmm.
One being the song You,
yep.
Which she didn't record evidently, but he did, despite it being in a bit high of a key for him to sing.
Yes.
But he got a hit out of it in 75 for the Extra Texture album.
Yeah.
But prior to that, 1971, when they were recording with her, the public collaboration between Phil and George and Ronnie made it as far as one single, which didn't do very well.
Mm-hmm.
Try Some, Buy Some.
That's right.
And as Ronnie has said, of the songs that they offered her, it was her least favorite.
Mm.
It was the one that she just couldn't wrap her head around being sort of, you know, this philosophical, typical George thing. And I mean, she does a fine job on it for somebody who is absolutely disengaged from what they're singing.
Yeah.
And so George repurposed it himself
yes.
for the 73 Living in the Material World album
yep.
using the same backing track.
Correct. Yes.
And even though Spector did not produce that album on the one cut, which was a leftover, he was, of course, involved with the production of that.
Yeah.
So there it would have died in obscurity as just an album track on, albeit...
And it did for 30-odd years.
Albeit a number one album at the time. Yeah. But it never, as far as my ears heard, ever got spun on the radio.
No.
But, and who picks it up 30 years later?
Yeah, for his reality album in 2003,
yeah.
Bowie recorded it. And, well, first of all, let's just listen to his version, and I'll give you a bit of backstory.
Yes.
We're back in time, someone said try some. I tried some, now buy some. I bought some. Ooh. After a while, when I had tried them, denied them, I opened my eyes and I saw you. Not a thing did I have, not a thing did I see, till I called on your love, and your love came to me.
Now, at the time of that album's release, the reality album in 2003, I interviewed Tony Visconti, and I then interviewed David Bowie. It was a phone interview. And I, in quickly researching this show, unearthed that interview, and to my dismay, realized that when I spoke with him about Try Some, Buy Some, it must have been before we were rolling tape. So there's a lesson right there. Always roll tape right from the get-go.
But maybe you dreamed it.
Yeah, there you go. But I do remember what was funny. It's always good to kind of try and impress your interviewee that you know what you're talking about. And, of course, he just happened to mention this track, that this was on the new album, and said, no, it's mostly something you've never heard before, heard of. And, of course, me being, you know, George Harrison friendly, if you like, you know, I just sort of said, oh yeah, I know that. And in fact, the B-side was called Tandoori Chicken, and he was blown away. It was like, my God, how do you know that? No one's ever heard of this.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's quite the feather in the cap, Richard.
Yeah. So actually, here's a little bit on this day that we're, you know, reminiscing about David Bowie.
Yes.
And
Bowie.
No. Let's get this straight. I've been tolerating this up until this point. It is Bowie. He would have called himself Bowie.
And not in America. Yeah. And he took his name from an American.
As
did he not?
Usual. Yeah. As usual. Yeah, here we go. We've got to right. change it. So I spoke with David Bowie. And here's a little bit where he was talking about, actually I asked him about a bad personal habit of his, amongst many, I'm sure, but one that is kind of a bit ironic, discussed this subject on this particular day.
Is it also easier to sing since you stopped smoking?
Yes, I suppose it is. Yeah, I guess I'm reaching better notes. Yeah. I don't want to talk about it. Yeah, it's. I guess it had to happen.
Yeah.
At some point or other, you know. Yeah. I mean, for, you know, not just for me, but for the sake of family and all that.
Yes.
So I've got people around now, you know.
Yeah.
My responsibilities are very different from what they used to be.
Right.
It wasn't a pleasurable decision. I used to adore smoking. Yeah. I'm not saying. On the other hand, it's a filthy habit.
Yeah. So, do you, I mean, is it just a desire of yours to always, you know, do something different? Do you feel a need to keep changing?
Well, not for the sake of it. I mean,
I don't mean for the sake of it, but I mean, is it... Do you just get easily bored?
I mean, even though probably the subject matter remains much the same from album to album, I don't think I write a terribly wide range of subjects. My excitement is in finding a new way of approaching that same subject.
Yeah.
And I think most writers, at heart, that is what they do. They have maybe only a small basket of subjects that they write about.
Yeah.
But they try and reapproach those subjects differently every time, and that's what I tend to do as a writer.
Yes.
And I probably will deal with the same senses of kind of isolation and lack of communications and all these kind of negatives, but I'll probably deal with them to the end of my life.
Right.
And certain spiritual questionings and all that. It won't change very much. It never has done, it appears, from Major Tom through to Heathen.
Yeah.
It's not that. It's all about the same thing.
Yes.
It really is.
Yeah.
And that obviously is that's my big four or five questions are in there somewhere.
Right. Right. Are you any closer to getting them out?
Abs, of course not. You know, it's the kind of, one takes these questions to the grave, but the human instinct is to keep on, you know. The human wants to join up one fact with another. The mind will always try and make a connection between one thing and another. That's the thing that intellectually makes us different any other being.
Absolutely.
Is that trying to join up makes sense of two different things.
Yeah.
You know, but I just kind of made it a writing process.
Yeah.
You know, hearing him talk like that, and what's obviously something he's given a lot of thought to, it's kind of comforting to hear in a day like this where we're shocked and mourning his passing. It's almost Harrisonian that he was thinking, you know, big picture beyond this life.
Yeah.
In those sort of terms. And here he is casually tossing that out, you know, before he's sick, before he has any reason to really be thinking about mortality. But there it is.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a cool thing to hear.
Yeah, because we always had George, if you remember, in the early 90s, I think, commenting on about his smoking habit is going to catch up with him if he doesn't give it up soon.
Yeah. Yeah. And they all smoke like fiends. And yet,
And we I have to say that at this point, I'm sure it'll become clear, most likely by the time, you know, this show is broadcast, but right now we don't know. We know he was struggling with cancer. We don't know what form of cancer, but I'm sure smoking couldn't have helped.
Definitely. Yeah. And which he himself admits before he even was diagnosed.
Yeah.
But yeah, we know.
Now, another thing that's really, you know, kind of fascinating for me is that apparently, you know, he was really influenced by John Lennon Plastic Ono Band album in 1970, Bowie.
Well, you did a cover of Mother.
Yes, he did. Mm-hmm. Yes, he did. Actually, let's take a quick listen.
Mother, you had me, but I never had you. I wanted you, but you didn't want me. So I just gotta tell you, goodbye.
That was a tribute recording, wasn't it? One of those Lennon birthday tributes that gets organized every fifth year.
Right. But Peter Doggett, the author of the book, The Man Who Sold the World, he
said, as well as You Never Give Me Your Money.
Yeah.
Great book.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's author of actually quite a few really good books.
He's out of the British music magazines, right?
Well, he wrote, he worked for, you know, Sean O'Money, Beatles Monthly magazine.
Oh, is that right?
So, yeah, so when it was revived in, you know, the 70s and 80s, Peter was involved with that.
So he was
and
a
with
colleague.
Record collector as well.
He was a colleague of yours.
Well, I wasn't on staff. He was on staff. I did some
contributor?
Freelance work.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you were aware of each other.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. We know each other. Yeah.
Okay.
So he said that. What?
All Brits know each other.
Oh, well, yeah, of course. It's so small there, those aisles off to the side. He said that the guitarist Adrian Belew recalled working on a whole set of Plastic Ono Band-inspired tracks.
Who?
With Bowie. The guitarist Adrian Belew.
He needed the money?
Yeah, he recalled working on a whole set of Plastic Ono Band-inspired tracks with Bowie, must say around the sort of late 70s or even early 1980, but that Bowie never completed or issued them. And Doggett's statement was that perhaps he was hoping that he might persuade Lennon himself to join in the studio until fate and a madman intervened.
Wouldn't that have been something?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's funny because when I think about that period of when John resurfaced and then was taken, my association with Bowie was, you know, he put out the Ashes to Ashes album, which was a great, great album. I remember just loving that, and especially the promo film he did for the title song.
Yeah.
Scary Monsters was the name of the album, not Ashes to Ashes. But he was also on Broadway doing Elephant Man.
Absolutely. Yeah, John commented on that in one of his final interviews.
Right.
You know.
And that would have been, if that would have maybe drawn John to doing some theater,
right,
wouldn't that have been a cool
one? Yeah. Now, here's something also fascinating from that period, actually 1979, is that Bowie re-recorded Space Oddity.
Mm.
I don't know if you've heard that version. It was the B-side of his single Alabama Song, which was issued in February of 1980.
Was this the Plastic Ono Band take?
Right, exactly. It's a stripped-down acoustic version, and it eventually made its way onto the 1992 Ryko disc reissue of his Scary Monsters and Super Creeps album.
Yes.
But if you listen to this, the acoustic opening, it's, you know, pretty sort of standard, pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
But where the track gets interesting is about just under a minute into the track. He suddenly is sort of like supported by exactly the same combination of instruments that you hear on a track like Mother, you know, Lennon's version on Plastic Ono Band, where you've got just piano, bass and drums.
Mm.
And there's even a solitary bass drum, you know, before the instrumental. And that's borrowed really from Lennon's Isolation.
Or Iron Man.
Let's just listen to the track.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom. Commencing countdown, engines on. Check ignition and may God's love be with you. Tom, you've really made the grade, and the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. Now it's time to leave the capsule if you dare. This is Major Tom to ground control. I'm stepping through the door, and I'm floating in the most peculiar way, and the stars look very different today, for
Mother meets Isolation.
Ziggy, is dead.
I mean, that one you don't have to kind of focus too closely, do you, to hear it? I mean,
oh, God. It jumps right out at you.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, did he ever comment on that, or did anybody ever acknowledge what is clearly an homage to Plastic Ono Band?
Yeah, I don't know, to be honest with you. I don't want to say yes or no to that.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was buried as a B-side, huh?
Yes. Huh. Yeah. So, yeah, and people
this sort
can,
of supports what Adrian Belew was saying.
Huh?
It supports what Adrian Belew was saying
yes.
about this. I mean, geez, can it be any more Plastic Ono Band?
Absolutely.
Wow.
So, yeah, people want to hear it. They don't have to just get the B-side, but get the 1993 reissue of Scary Monsters, and it's one of the bonus tracks.
You know, he was not an overtly political guy as an artist.
Right.
He was sort of, he transcended that. He could do, you know, he could influence things politically, but not in a, like, you know, a direct sort of party or a single issue thing. I think he was more anthemic.
Yes.
Nowhere more than the song Heroes.
Right.
Which is in quotes.
Yes.
By the way.
Yes.
It's not just the word Heroes.
Correct.
But when I think about that song, I always kind of correlate it as sort of, if he had an Imagine, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, I mean, it was got a lot of play after 9/11,
yep.
as you may recall.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons, but also even earlier, going back to when he played Berlin in 1987
yeah.
while the wall was still up.
Yeah.
And that was one of the songs he performed. And, you know, it's one of those things like there's that PBS documentary, How the Beatles Rocked the Kremlin.
Yes.
And in Germany, they have sort of the same sense with Bowie as being one of the people that sort of, you know, united the youth to really get their act together in terms of fighting this tyranny, and 2 years later the wall came down.
Yeah, doesn't I think he performs Heroes, which by the way is most likely my favorite Bowie recording of all. I love that. I love the way that he progressively gets more manic, you know, in terms of his vocals
works
as the
up.
Song goes along.
Right.
It's a little bit like Lennon and Be My Baby, you know, it's just like getting out there.
Well, like and, Mother.
Yeah, yeah. And I think he performed it in the song Christiana F.
You oh, that could that? Be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you see him on stage performing it in that film.
And that's a whole other aspect of his career, you know, that you talk about the cinema work. You know, I haven't examined it that deeply to see if there's any other obvious Beatle ties, you know, in Man of Fell to Earth or things like that. But something that just sparked in my head was they did the film of, I think it was the last Ziggy show in 73.
Yes.
The Hammersmith show.
Yeah, correct.
They filmed the concert.
Yeah.
And I know that Ringo was there. And if you see the film, you see him backstage hanging out with Bowie.
Right. And didn't you say to me that they were pretty good friends?
Enough that, you know, they could, you know, visit and hang out with each other. Not that they ever did anything collaborative, which would have been fascinating.
Mm. Like, well, Bowie was nothing if not eclectic. So, yeah.
If he could work with Stevie Ray Vaughan, he could work with anybody.
Right.
You know,
right.
You talk about somebody far afield from your normal scope of things.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So, as we now wind down this remembrance of Bowie, I think it's really cool now that you connect the dots to sort of see how somebody who you really rightly regard as their own individual artist,
yes,
covering an array of personas and sounds and everything, and yet still have so many close ties to the gift that keeps on giving, which is the Beatles in their collective or individual forms.
Yes.
You know, there it is.
Yeah.
It's just amazing to me. And we could do shows like this and probably any number of people,
mm-hmm.
and someday we will.
Yeah.
Hopefully not when they drop dead, but, you know, just as sort of a connecting the dots exercise with what might not be obvious connections.
Yeah.
But there they are.
Yeah. I have to say that it was my daughter, Melanie, I'll give her a shout out, that she called me at 1:45 in the morning. The phone goes, and I think, oh, God, emergency, what's going on here? And she called me to say, I just got to tell you, David Bowie has died. And it was like, what? You know, 69 years old. And immediately that set my mind thinking about doing this show. So we've had to cobble this together in just a few hours. So.
Well, it's interesting because I was thinking about Friday, or January 8th is my daughter's birthday, as well as Bowie's.
Okay.
And so it's something that, because she's very musically curious, you know, we've all her life, as well as with my son, been playing an array of music. And so she was like, I want to know what does Bowie sound like? Could you play me some
and
Bowie?
And I take you also played her some Elvis, being at his birthday.
Oh, yeah,
also.
Both. Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. So it sort of just underscores the musical reach across generations that, you know, she was quite happy. You know, I always thought it was great where, what a canny selection of cover for Nirvana and Unplugged when they did The Man Who Sold the World.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, where did that come from?
Right.
But that's a group that started out, their very first single was Shocking Blue, Love Buzz.
Yeah.
You know, not even a hit in America.
Right.
And that was their first single. So when they're doing the Unplugged, and of course this was during Kurt's lifetime,
yeah.
You know, the stage is set very, very sort of funereal, mm-hmm. you know, with the candles and mm-hmm. flowers and everything. And so it got played during his lifetime, but after he died, you know, and it was, you know, 24/7 rotation on MTV.
Yes.
That was the jump out track.
Yes.
Their cover of The Man Who Sold the World. And even lyrically, you could see how it got a little spooky, you know, in the context of death, that was a song that Kurt, for whatever reason, thought would be a fitting song for them to perform in that venue.
Yeah.
It's sort of a little eerie, but
it's also that song that Lulu, of all people, had a hit version of it in the 1970s in the UK, at least.
Yeah.
And Bowie produced it, and I think he played the sax on it.
Oh, is that interesting?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's totally different meaning.
Yes. Yeah, it's totally.
We're talking death of a career or something.
Yeah. Well, anyway, as we close out the show, we've got, of course, another great collaboration.
Yeah, let's go full circle with this.
Yes, between David Bowie and John Lennon.
Across the Universe.
Yeah, one of John's great songs, and one of the ones that he always said he wanted to re-record. And he got to do it in a kind of roundabout way, not, you know, as a solo recording, but mm-hmm. in collaboration with David Bowie.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure that was what he had in mind, but I'm happy to have it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, my name is Richard Buskin.
This is Robert Rodriguez.
And this has been an episode of Something About the Beatles.
On David Bowie.
Words are flowing out like endless rain into a paper cup. They slither wildly as they slip away across the universe. Pools of sorrow, waves of joy are drifting through my open mind, possessing and caressing me.
Something About the Beatles, produced by Thomas Rapetney, executive produced by Rick Way, title song by The Corgis.
And how do you say your son's name?
Zoe.
Your son's name is Zoe Bowie.
Yeah.
My name's David Bowie.
This is David Bowie singing Golden Years. I'll be David Bowie.
Oh, I'm David Bowie. I live down the road.
Oh. Is this the real David Bowie? The world is going to die, says David Bowie.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.